This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on the Cuban Five.
One of the more recent outrages, what our country is doing to those who are trying to stop terrorism against Cuba.
We'll also bring you a very special segment on how music is used to torture people.
A remarkable segment about how U.S. psychological operations using some of the famous singers you've heard, but blast them at people 24 hours a day, hooded, listening to this music, breaking them down and tearing apart humans.
And today we'll also bring you a segment on how thousands of Armenian Americans protested PBS's decision to include a panel discussion following a one-hour documentary on the Armenian Genocide.
The Armenian Genocide in the early 20th century, denied by many, but finally, a protest against that denial wins. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
On February 14th, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in Atlanta in the case of the so-called Cuban Five. Five Cuban men had been serving harsh prison sentences for nearly 8 years after infiltrating anti-Cuban right-wing terrorist groups in South Florida. They were arrested by U.S. authorities in 1998 and received a highly politicized trial in Miami. The recent oral arguments came in the wake of a decision this past summer by the circuit to order a new trial. Initially, the pretrial publicity rendered it impossible for the Cuban Five to receive a fair trial in Miami. This morning on Law and Disorder, we are honored to be talking with Ricardo Alarcón, president of the Cuban National Assembly. Good morning, Mr. Alarcón. Welcome to Law and Disorder. One of the issues that I wanted to mention is the lack in the American media of any coverage about the case of the Cuban Five. We'll be talking about some of the legal aspects in a few minutes with Len Weinglass, attorney, who just completed oral arguments in Atlanta. But what would you like to tell the American media, in addition to the fact that this is another example of the United States, a powerful country, wielding its weight against five individuals who were really trying to do good and trusted the FBI and went to them? What else should our listeners know about this story?
While in its merit, it should have been on the front lines of every paper and at every news service on the big TV stations for practically every day. Someday, some people will ask very simple questions. How was it possible that hundreds of MPs in Britain, for example, or dozens of them in the Belgium, in France, in other countries, have been trying to get their own governments involved in this case, have been asking questions to their governments, have been denouncing, and not a single single member of your parliament, not a single minute have been devoted or have been ever mention of this case. Someday, somehow, Americans will learn about that. That in other countries, you have had editorials, you have had the important personalities being concerned with this case, from first ladies, head of Supreme Courts in some countries, members of the highest courts in other countries, members of parliaments, religious leaders, Nobel Peace Prize, Nobel Literature or Peace Prizes winners, thousands upon thousands of people outside the United States have been trying their best to get others involved, and everybody always reached the same astonishing conclusion. Wow! How is it possible that this issue practically doesn't exist in the American media?
Yes, our government has claimed that a national priority, so this is ironic when faced with evidence like this that we engage in a conspiracy of silence and cover-up. Let me just ask you, when this summer we had a positive development in the case with the 11th Circuit, were you surprised by that decision, saying that the venue choice had been unfair?
It was really one of the few moments of happiness, as one of the wives said in this case. First of all, because it was really a big surprise. Nobody was expecting such a decision to come suddenly after months of wait. Suddenly, it was in August the 9th, at the moment where usually you don't expect big news here or there. Suddenly, this decision was announced. I think that it was a very positive development, especially in one way. It showed that notwithstanding all the manipulations, all the negative aspects surrounding this case, notwithstanding all of that, in your country, there are decent human beings. There are persons of integrity, of honesty, of that respect themselves and their profession. And that was, in the final analysis, the consequence of the reason how and why such a determination could come from those three judges. Then, from that moment, a new source of optimism surrounded this case. Many people doubted very much that justice could be done to these five fine Cubans. Suddenly, when you have this pronouncement of these three judges, they discover that notwithstanding all the things that can be criticized regarding the certain aspects of the imperial policy of your country, notwithstanding all of that, you can also count on the virtues and the integrity of the old.
Well, in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Leonard Weinglass, who's going to continue this discussion in terms of the recent oral arguments and what our chances are for the outcome, which may be several months from now.
At this moment, it's something that I would like to stress. At this moment, apart from the so-called trial that took place in Miami, two other instances, five judges from other countries, the UN Working Group, three American judges in Atlanta, that is, means eight judges in two separate process of analysis and revision of all aspects of the process, have reached the same unanimous conclusion that these five individuals have been victims of a clear injury.
President Alarcon, we're unfortunately out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder. And I think the point you made about when a few individuals care about this and share the word, we just have to keep telling this story and hoping that our government will finally listen. And that's what we're hoping for in the 11th Circuit decision that we're waiting for. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much.
Okay, I hope to see you soon.
I look forward to.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Len Wineglass has been a leading American constitutional criminal lawyer since the 60s. He goes back to the days of the Pentagon Papers case. He represented Angela Davis. His most recent triumph was in doing the legal groundwork that has put Mumia in a much better position today than he used to be. And he's now the lead counsel for the Cuban Five.
Len, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Attorney Len Wineglass, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder. I know you're freshly back from arguing in Atlanta, Georgia, to the full Court of Appeals on the Cuban Five case, and we wanted to get an update for our listeners from you. Can you tell us how it went and what's at stake?
Yes. After we won a unanimous decision by the three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit on August 9th, and they wrote an unprecedented 93-page opinion, the entire court, 13 judges minus one who recused himself, agreed to take the case then on appeal from that decision. And we argued it on February 14th before the entire 12 members of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. They allocated 20 minutes for each side for the argument. Actually, we took a little longer than that. But it was a very active court, asking many questions of both ourselves and the government representative.
Is that a good sign that you have what we used to call a hot bench?
Yes, it was a hot bench, and we anticipated that it would be. Unfortunately, the ones who were active were the ones who we knew on the ideological divide would be either for us or against us. The ones who had to be won over in the middle did not actively participate in the argument.
Len, I'm aware that they asked you to focus on three main areas in your arguments. What were those?
Yes, the question was whether or not the judge applied the right standard in refusing the change venue out of Miami. And on that issue, we were in a very strong position because the trial judge applied a standard that had never previously been used by any other trial court outside the 11th Circuit in the entire United States throughout our history. So we felt that it would be unlikely that this court would approve that unprecedented standard that the trial court used. And the court seemed to accept the argument without question. Actually, they questioned the government's attorney on that standard. The other issues were less significant, but they had to do with questions of the standard that the reviewing court should use and deciding whether or not they could review the factual findings by the trial court. The trial court found that the survey, which was introduced showing prejudice in Miami, was not methodologically sound, and so she rejected the survey. We asked the appellate court to reverse that finding. They questioned us about the standard that was used. There were also questions raised about whether or not we had failed to preserve the argument on venue by virtue of the fact that we did not renew the motion to change venue after the jury was selected.
That seems to me to be a pretty good argument for the government, wouldn't you think so?
That one was difficult for us, and you're right. We were questioned very closely on that. But the fact of the matter is that we made a change of venue motion, and it was renewed before trial, and it was renewed three times during trial. It was just not reviewed at the conclusion of the jury selection. So there were five motions made to change venue, but the government focuses on the one time that it should have been renewed, and it actually wasn't.
How I know you were recently in Cuba. You reported on how the argument went. What do you think the mood and the feeling is down in Havana and throughout Cuba? I know that the people of the island are very aware and have been following this case ever since these people went to prison 8 years ago. What was your sense of how they think about things are going now in Cuba?
Well, the Cubans have a view of this case, as five of their people have now served almost 8 years in the worst prisons in the United States, separated and isolated. And they feel that they know that they did no damage in the United States. They harmed no one. They were never armed. And they feel that it's unjustified to keep the five of them there on a mission to stop terrorism and to save lives in their homeland, who did no damage and injured no one, to keep them in a prison that long. As you know, Michael, by any international standard, 8 years is way beyond what people who are charged with these kinds of offenses would do in almost any other country under any circumstance.
Len, what kind of original evidence was there 8 years ago of spying? Did the five transmit U.S. secrets to Cuba?
Well, the government acknowledged in its opening statement that they did not, that the government intercepted 20,000 pages of correspondence between the five and Cuba, and there was not a single page of classified information. But the government argued to the jury that this case does not require a finding of espionage, that this case is a conspiracy case. And all the jury has to find, in order to find them guilty, is that they must have agreed that at some point in the future they would transmit classified or national defense information. So the conspiracy charge, as it's always true in political cases, relieved the government of the requirement that they prove the crime.
It's really like a thought crime, isn't it? It just plays on people's prejudices and fears.
Exactly right. How do you prove an agreement? You prove an agreement by inference. You show that the five knew each other and the five came from Cuba. Therefore, they must have had an agreement. It's all inferential. And when you're dealing with Cubans and you're before a Miami jury, that jury will draw the inference.
Lenny, this is Michael Ratner speaking. In the argument on venue in front of the 11th Circuit, did they go into the other issues, the other substantial issues about the fairness of the trial and the charges, or was it strictly a venue argument?
No, they did go into the key issue, and that was how could the government deny venue when the five sought venue, and then 1 year later apply for venue, the very same office, when they were defending the Attorney General of the United States in a civil case, and they felt because Cuba was involved that their client, the Attorney General, could not get a fair trial in Miami.
No,
and they got a change
no.
of venue.
That's an incredible contradiction, and I think that's what you actually won the case on originally, was really that amazing government being two-faced on that issue.
Yes.
But I'm asking another question, Lenny. The other issues in the case that you asked for reversal on were not just venue. There were other issues, right?
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, what happened with that, Michael, was this. The when we appeared before the panel, the three-judge panel, they decided the case on the single issue of venue and acknowledged that they did not reach the other seven issues which we had raised. When the en banc court took the case up on review, they only took up the venue issue. So, in other words, the seven other issues are still awaiting determination in before a panel. If we lose on this, then we go back before the panel, and we argue and get a decision on the remaining seven issues.
Wow. But all this time, of course, the Cuban Five remain imprisoned.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And what contact have they been allowed with their families recently?
Well, as you know, two of the five, Rene Gonzalez and Gerardo Hernandez, have not been permitted to see their wives for over 7 years. And in the case of Rene, his infant daughter, who was born after he was arrested. So their cases have been taken up by the National Council of Churches, Amnesty International, the European Union. I think there's a resolution in the British Parliament, the Irish Parliament. But the State Department refuses to grant their wives, Adriana and Olga, who live in Cuba, a visa so that they could come to the United States to visit their husbands. This has been termed by both Amnesty International and the National Council of Churches as a form of torture.
Do you have any indication from your arguments in February which way the magistrates might be leaning?
The arguments we just concluded?
Yes.
It's very hard to say. First, it's before 12 judges. Two judges were very clear in the argument, at least they appeared to be, quite hostile to our position. And two judges appeared to be very favorable, if you can go by their questions, which is not always necessarily an accurate measure. But the remaining judges did not question, except one other, and he was President Bush's most recent addition to the 11th Circuit, a judge, Judge Pryor, who was filibustered by the Democrats, and his nomination failed. But then, as a compromise of the 14, he was one of the five who finally was accepted, and he's sitting, and he sat on this argument, and he offered some comment which was highly negative to our side.
One last question, Len, because we know you've got to run. Why was it that the Cuban government sent these five young men to Miami in the first place?
Well, it followed a long history. When the Cubans attempted to initiate a tourism industry after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the amount of violence directed against Cuba by the exile community in Miami through mercenary actions increased. There were bombings, and the new airport terminal had a bomb placed in it. Buses had bombs placed in it. Ships were also placed offshore and fired cannons into the hotels. One Italian tourist was killed when a bomb went off in the lobby. The Cubans protested to the United States each of these actions, and then they brought a case before the Security Council alleging terrorism initiated by the United States, or people within the United States, I should say, directed against Cuba, and the United States was hosting these groups. The UN did nothing. The United States never responded to any of the complaints. And finally, the Cubans sent over these five in order to monitor the activities of the groups that were directed against them. And they succeeded, and they infiltrated these groups, which had training camps and armed camps, and they reported back to Cuba about the activities of these groups.
Didn't they also try to get the United States involved in stopping these attacks? After all, it's against the Neutrality Act. It's a violation to launch armed attacks against a country that you're at peace with. Didn't the Cubans try to get them to stop it, and instead the United States betrayed the Cubans and instead arrested the Cuban Five?
Yes, you're right. That happened just prior to the arrests, actually about 5 months prior to the arrests. The Cubans succeeded and having a delegation from the FBI come down to Havana, and they met with members of the Interior Department who had presented the FBI with three or four volumes of materials that had been gathered on the activities of these groups, naming names, designating places, revealing the activities that were planned. The equipment that was used, the armaments, the explosives, they were given photographs, they were given tape recordings, and the FBI delegation thanked the Cubans for this information, returned to Washington with the materials and did nothing, and then arrested the five.
You know,
also, I should add that when the FBI did nothing over a period of time, the Cubans provided a copy of all that material to the New York Times, which printed none of it.
Yeah. Political cases are kind of a sign of their times. That we think of the Rosenberg case, for example, during the McCarthy era. And I think in terms of just the kind of hypocrisy that this American government represents with respect to their whole fake war on terrorism, this frame-up and imprisonment of the Cuban Five who are only trying to stop terrorism is really one of the hallmark cases of our era.
Yes, I agree completely with you, Michael. And it's even more graphically drawn when you consider the fact that Dr. Bosch, who attacked Cuba and has admitted it, and was deemed to be the leading terrorist of the Western Hemisphere by our Department of Justice, was granted residential status by President Bush, the first President Bush, who overruled the Justice Department. And he lives comfortably in Miami today. And Mr. Carriles, who was involved in the bombing of the Cuban commercial aircraft that crashed and killed over 73 people, he is now given preferential status. He's being held in an immigration center, but they refuse to extradite him back to Venezuela, where he is facing charges on that bombing. So these are examples of the most extreme terrorist elements that live here in the United States, both of them getting very favorable treatment by the government of the United States.
Len, when can we expect to hear on the recent arguments?
Very difficult to predict that. The court has no deadline. When we argued before the three-judge panel, they took 16 months before they wrote an opinion. I think we're going to get a decision sooner than that. But it's very clear to us that the 11th Circuit Court, the 12 judges, are divided and sharply divided. So I don't know how long it will take for them to reconcile their differences, if that's going to happen, or to publish a majority and a dissenting opinion. So we're just waiting, but I don't think it will take the 16 months that the three-judge panel took.
Len, we really appreciate your giving us an update and being with us once again on Law and Disorder.
You have our respect and admiration and solidarity, Len Weinglass. We'll have you back on and hopefully to announce a victory.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Lenny.
Right, thanks.
The music you've been listening to is from Metallica, and the song is called Enter Sandman. We're bringing you today a short special about the music of torture. We'll try and explore this in more depth as we go on with our show, but today we want to give you a taste of some of what the United States government is doing in its psychological and stress torture of Guantanamo detainees as well as detainees from Iraq. In the news lately has been the fact that the U.S. has been using music blared 24 hours a day at detainees who are pinned down to the ground. The earphones are put on them, hoods are put on them, and they're forced to listen to various music for 24 hours a day. The piece you just heard is by Metallica called Enter Sandman. Other musicians that whose material has been used for torture are Eminem, Christina Aguilera, and even the Sesame Street theme. One of the clients of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a man named Al-Khatani, who is in Guantanamo, has gone through extensive torture in Guantanamo. He was known as the so-called 20th hijacker. It's not clear at all that he had anything to do with 9/11 or the hijacking. But his torture has been described vividly in a log kept by the administration. And it included keeping him locked in a room, lengthening interrogation sessions, beginning at midnight and ending when Al-Khatani goes to sleep. They then rouse Al-Khatani by dripping water on his head or playing the music of Christina Aguilera. At one point, they go on, they play the music loudly. They then put a puppet show on, satirizing the detainee's supposed involvement with Al-Qaeda. Al-Khatani is then taken to another interrogation booth, which is decorated with pictures of 9/11 victims, American flags, and red lights. Then, music again, he has to stand for the playing of the U.S. national anthem. They shave his head and beard. He's returned to the original interrogation booth, where again, music is played, a picture of a 9/11 victim is taped to his trousers, and he repeats that he won't talk until he's interrogated in a proper way. Now, the musical element of this, of course, is one element of what we have described before on this program that the expert on torture, Al McCoy, has described as the U.S. psychological and stress torture that eventually utterly destroys people's personalities. And in fact, that's the purpose. And some of the U.S. people who've spoken about this, for example, the U.S. Psychological Operations Company, said that the aim was to break a prisoner's resistance through sleep deprivation and playing music that was culturally offensive to them. Another person, Sergeant Mark Hadsell of Psychological Operations, told Newsweek magazine, "These people haven't heard heavy metal." And he went on to say, "They can't take it. If you play it for 24 hours, your brain and body functions start to slide. Your train of thought slows down and your will is broken. That's when we come in and talk to them." Now remember, we're going to play different cuts of music for you that are used by U.S. psychological operations to torture people in Iraq, in Guantanamo, and in other CIA hellholes around the world. To get a real sense of what they're doing, I mean, you can't get the real sense because you won't be in custody, you won't be chained to the floor, but if you want to really get the sense, cover your eyes, put a hood over your head, put earphones on your head, and turn the volume up almost all the way, and stay there. I'm not going to tell you to stay there for 24 hours, but stay there. Try and stay in that position for 30 seconds. What's interesting about her song and some of the other music that's chosen is a lot of it comes out of the 90s, which is a cultural indication of the age of the torturers who are actually engaging in the torture, because this is the music that they're familiar with from their youth. They're not using Beatles songs and songs from my youth. They're using songs that are culturally, they have a feeling for.
We learned from Professor Al McCoy's great book, A Question of Torture, that the United States developed from 1950 to 1961 the method that they have now perfected and which they're using in Guantanamo. It's called touchless torture. It's two things, really. It's sensory deprivation, or its opposite, sensory overload, that is, this music blared. And it's also self-inflicted pain, like making somebody stand up for 40 hours. If you use both of them, the American manuals brag that they can put a person in a state of acute psychosis within 48 hours. And this isn't something that you can wash away like a bloodstain. When somebody is made crazy like this, they are crippled for life. And this is what they're doing. And the music that you're hearing now is an aspect of the American torture program.
I love you, you love me, we're a happy family. With a great big hug and a kiss from me to you, won't you say you love me too? I love you, you love me, we're best friends like friends should be.
Songs from the Purple Singing Dinosaur, Barney, are also on the list of songs that they play to torture people. One person from psychological operations told the BBC, in training, they forced me to listen to the Barney I Love You song for 45 minutes. I never want to go through that again, the PSYOPs guy said. Now remember, this was only 45 minutes, and this is the psychological operations guy. They're putting this on 24 hours a day.
With a great big hug and a kiss from me to you, won't you say you love me too?
One interesting comment in terms of what Michael Smith was saying about Al McCoy's book and the long-term effects of this kind of torture on people. Al McCoy says that psychological torture and stress is actually more permanent as a means of long-term effect on people than physical beatings. And we've had that verified by other of the Center for Constitutional Rights clients and others who say the psychological pain of torture, of being tortured in the way that we're describing on this station, is much worse than actually being physically beaten. And what's interesting about this is there's a man named Rick Hoffman, who is the vice president of the Psychological Ops Operations Veterans Association. You can imagine, what do they do for kicks in that Veterans Association? Listen to Barney. Anyway, this guy told BBC Radio 4 that this kind of torture that we're talking about here, of music torture, long sleep deprivation, etc., quote, would have no long-lasting effect on prisoners. So what you see them putting forth is the complete opposite of this kind of what this kind of torture does to people. Here you have these guys who do it claiming that it has no long-term effects on people, when in fact it damages them for life.
What was so moving was to read about Maher Arer, the Canadian citizen who had the misfortune of passing through JFK Airport. He got ripped off by the United States government, sent to Syria, was tortured for a year using these kinds of torture methods, because the United States has spread them globally now. And now that he's back in Canada, he's a mess. And I read an article about what he just does from day to day. He can't hold down a job. He can't relate to his wife or his children. He has all kinds of doubts about himself. He has nightmares. I mean, he's been scarred for life. And if you look at him, you couldn't tell. It's touchless torture.
What Arar actually said was really interesting. He was beaten with a cable for a couple of weeks. And he compared that to being in this underground prison, 3 feet wide, 6 feet high, 7 feet long, with rats and urine dripping on him and all kinds of stuff, and hearing the screams of torture and having other torture instruments in the torture room. And he compared the beatings that he had, the physical beatings that took place over a period of 2 or 3 weeks, to the psychological torture of being in this situation as well as being threatened and hearing the screams of other people. And he said there's no comparison. He said his life, it was one of the most moving interviews I ever heard. He said his life has been destroyed by the psychological torture. The beatings were not what did it, but his life has been really, really harmed by the psychological torture. And here you have the so-called Veterans of PSYOPs, which is obviously a pretty bad organization, talking about how it doesn't have long-term effects. There's a history to this. To the use of this kind of torture, this stress that Michael Smith mentioned in terms of Al McCoy's book on the question of torture. But the history of music also, which we'll just start to get into a little bit here, we know that the Israeli government used many of these same techniques in the late 90s, where they would put bags over their heads, and they would also use music as a means of torture. And of course, if people may recall that when Manuel Noriega was when they captured him in Panama when the U.S. invaded, they to try and drive him out of his house, they set up huge loudspeakers that blared music into his house as a means of driving him out. And it goes back, and we haven't really looked at the origins of all of this, but we know that the Chinese have used it as a torture technique in their prisons. And in our next shows, we'll try and bring you some more history of music as torture.
I think the Israelis also did it to Yasser Arafat when they had him caught in his compound. One of the really awful things about these torture methods is that they spread quickly. They spread through the United States government agencies quickly, and they spread to other governments quickly, and it becomes a global phenomena. And one of the worst days in the history of the United States is to see that the United States is in the vanguard of this spread.
Again, we're going to play another cut for you from some of the songs that have been used to really get the focus of it. Shut your eyes, turn your radio all the way up, and imagine yourself being hooded, chained to the floor, no sleep, and hungry, and having
cold,
and be in someone else's custody in some, you know, offshore island where there's no law, no lawyers.
And no hope.
And no hope, really. Imagine that, and then having this stuff blasted in your ears for 24 hours a day.
From the Indians who welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain.
Thousands of Armenian Americans recently protested PBS's decision to include a panel discussion after a one-hour documentary called The Armenian Genocide on April 17th. The panel was to have been about Turkey's role in the genocide of Armenians during and after World War I. The documentary airs 1 week before the annual Armenian Remembrance Day commemoration. The 25-minute program that was to have followed has generated an outcry because the panel was to have included two scholars who deny that 1.5 million Armenian civilians were killed in eastern Turkey from 1915 to 1920. Armenian Americans publicized an online petition asking PBS to drop the discussion.
With us today on Law and Disorder is Detroit National Lawyers Guild attorney Victor Papakian. Victor Papakian practiced law in Detroit for 40 years. His father was the Armenian Bishop of Detroit and a socialist as well, actually. Victor has studied the history of the Armenian people and followed this denial of the reality of the slaughter of the Armenians and the role of the United States government and the Turkish government in it, and we're very glad to have him on Law and Disorder.
Victor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with the Armenian Genocide, could you explain what is so offensive about having a debate on public television about the actual existence of the genocide?
Well, it would be tantamount to having a view opposing emancipation at the end of the Civil War, having a program showing the emancipation and the aftermath of the Civil War, and then having a panel sitting there denying any benefit from the or denying the fact that slavery existed. And the same, you know, the classic case is the Holocaust in Europe, but removed the Jewish population from Europe. No one presents a program on the Holocaust documentary and then has a panel discussion full of deniers of the Holocaust. That's parallel with that.
Well, how do you explain that they have the chutzpah to use an Armenian phrase, to have this kind of discussion in the year 2005.
Let me just say something. They canceled it, you know. They're not doing the panel discussion. Didn't you guys know that? Is that right?
Well, I think my understanding is it's from station to station. The spokesman for the PBS said the PBS acknowledges that the Armenian experience was a genocide. In fact, the man who coined the word used the Armenian experience as the prime example. But the spokesman for PBS said that PBS, as a policy matter, just like the New York Times, now acknowledges the Armenian genocide. And then to acknowledge it and then to deny it is participating in the genocide, according to Helen Fine and the genocide scholars. If you actively deny a genocide, you participate. You're actually picking up a weapon and participating in the genocide. If you think about it, you'll see why that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. Victor, we've just got a bulletin here into the WBAI newsroom. PBS has decided to pull that panel. We've won this one. What's your reaction to that victory?
Well, I'm glad if that's the case, and I'm now curious what brought this panel on. I don't think PBS people went around looking for a panel to deny, and I don't think they're like, what's that O'Reilly guy?
No, the O'Reilly factor, right.
Yeah, who wants two sides to every story. Mm. I don't think they're in that mode, and I'd be curious if there's any way to find out what brought this panel on. It was interesting who was in the panel, really third-rate historian that's been doing this for, made a career out of it since the 70s.
Why hasn't this whole historical episode, really the first genocide of the 20th century, why hasn't it been discussed? Why do we still have to struggle to get it discussed?
Well, it was discussed contemporaneously. Genocide is not particularly a new event. It happens currently in Africa without anybody saying boo about it. From my perspective, this business with having a panel of genocide deniers violates a real principle of genocide studies that Helen Fine and Israel Charney were scholars in that field. Their position is, and it's an axiom in genocide studies, that the denial of genocide is the final act of genocide. It's a nice thing. It wraps everything up neatly, and the whole thing is forgotten.
Your parents went from Armenia to Syria, didn't they?
My mother did.
Yeah.
And both my parents did eventually, but they went different routes, of course.
Victor, my grandmother was a mail order bride. She saw her family being massacred and raped in front of her and luckily escaped to an orphanage. And then my grandfather, who had come over right before but didn't know her, paid for her passage.
Right. That's not an unusual story, unfortunately. A lot of American Armenians have that in their background. Incidentally, practically all Armenian Americans come from that area of Armenia that was genocided. I think that's a proper verb nowadays. The Caucasus Armenians did survive. They survived some plagues and things after World War I, but they did survive. They weren't killed off. And that's what constitutes the modern Republic of Armenia. But two-thirds of historic Armenia is gone.
Yeah. And the Armenians, if our listeners aren't aware of the history, were one of the first Christian nations along with the Greeks in the history of the world.
It was the first Christian nation.
In the 4th century. And the Turks didn't come to their part of the world until 8 centuries later. They were the latecomers. And they were Muslims, of course. And I think suspicious of the Christian Armenians during the First World War, accusing them of siding with the enemies of the Turks during the First World War. And that was fear that was whipped up amongst the Turks to facilitate the genocide.
Well, of course, the population that was killed off were civilians. All the male Armenians of under 50 or 60 were drafted into the Ottoman Empire. So the talk of armed rebellion in any serious way is ridiculous. All of this has been, you know, has completely undisputed until recent revisionism by the Turks. They want to join the European Union, and they want to act civilized and so forth. Of course, they still have many problems. This is when the denial began. It wasn't commonplace to deny the genocide. In fact, most absurd thing, the Turkish parliament approached the British parliament and asked them to have their records expunged from World War I.
Oh, really?
And they responded, they said, that's not going to happen.
But in the earlier part of the century, Armenia was the first country where the United States actually gave financial aid, wasn't it?
Well, they
and the phrase, think of the starving Armenians when people were eating, was popular around then.
Well, that's right. You know, a lot of the early feminists were involved in that. It was private aid. It wasn't. I don't think it was much government aid. They went around the country and stirred up sympathy and raised a lot of money. And a lot of survivors, I mean, like orphans and so forth, that made it benefited from that aid. Curious, if you read Balakian's book, it's interesting.
The Black Dog.
No, the other one, The Burning Tigris.
Oh yes, yeah.
You see a great book. Bunch old abolitionists, feminists, and things.
Right.
This is we're talking about 1915 period, going up to fight for some kind of humanistic struggle yet one more time. And fortunately, there aren't people like that around anymore. And I never realized the extent to which old lefties were involved in promoting the Armenian cause in World War One. I was happy to see that.
And, of course, there's the famous Armenian revolutionary who was one of the leaders of the Russian Revolution. You'll remind our listeners of his name?
Shaumian.
That's right.
Right. He was a member of the first Politburo.
That's right. That's right. Well,
he was assassinated.
Victor Papakian, we want to thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder today. We'll continue to follow the story. We've got hopes that they're going to completely ban this panel discussion by PBS, and we'll keep our listeners updated. Thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Goodbye, Victor.
For our listeners, we have a book just came out yesterday. It was launched at the town hall forum on impeachment. The book is called Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush, and it's written by the lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and particularly our own co-host Michael Ratner. It's a great book, short book, four chapters on four different reasons why Bush should be impeached. It's called Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush, and you can get it on the Center for Constitutional Rights website. Michael, give us that website.
It's ccr-ny.org. That's ccr-ny.org. We have a page on impeachment. We also have a page on the Guantanamo Action Center for shutting it down Guantanamo. You can get the book there. You can get active on the various issues from torture to Guantanamo to the impeachment issue. You can also get the book, I think, in most of your bookstores, as well as, of course, at the usual online sellers. But you can get it at the center's website, again, ccr-ny.org. What we tried to do in the book was explain in very straightforward terms why we think Bush ought to be impeached. And we go into a lot of substance as to what he has done, from national security, illegal wiretapping, to torture, to Guantanamo, to the illegal war in Iraq. I must say it was an amazing thing to actually sit down and write some of it, because you went into any depth on any of these issues, but particularly the war in Iraq. You realized that on every single day we were being told about Iraq and 9/11 or Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. This administration knew better and was lying to all of us.
Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. It's a Center for Constitutional Rights book. You can get it on the Center's website, and we'll make a link on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Pick it up and use it. We want to invite all the listeners to the Left Forum. It starts March 10th. Cooper Union goes Saturday the 11th and Sunday the 12th. Michael Ratner is going to be at the closing plenary Sunday evening on the 12th, and Sunday at 2 o'clock, your hosts from Law and Disorder are having a special panel called 10 Minutes to Midnight, the Emerging Police State. So all of you, take a look at our website, leftforum.org. You'll get the schedule. There are about 70 different panels. There'll be about 1,500 activists and scholars, leftists from all over the country, all over the world. It's the great event in the United States, the Left Forum, Cooper Union, starting the evening of March 10th, all day Saturday, March 11th, March 12th, with the dynamite special panel from your host at Law and Disorder called 10 Minutes to Midnight, the Emerging Police State. leftforum.org. Come join us. Come up and say hello to us.
I've met many people over the years, and in my opinion, I have found that people are the same everywhere.
And
And we want to thank for today's program Robin Ginsberg, who helped get the music for the torture music, and of course our wonderful producer, Jeff Brady.
The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
We break it all down in hopes that you might understand how to protect yourself. Don't make no profit for the man. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. You're something kind of funny. How the man take your money. He's shrewd as he can be. In such a way you'll never see. It's a terrible thing inside. When your natural high has died, the weaker turn to dope and put all aside their hope. And I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. See you.